with our opinion. We'll hear arguments first this morning in Barbara Blum, Commissioner of New York State Department of Social Services, against Yaretsky. Mrs. Gordon, you.
Justice, and may it please the Court, New York's alleged involvement in medical decisions about nursing home care for Medicaid patients was found below to constitute state action in two kinds of circumstances. A brief review of the kinds of circumstances in which state action was found to be present is necessary because that inquiry determines the additional question petitioners raise in this case, that is, the district court's jurisdiction under Article 3 to decide the claims that are now before you, and also it aids the inquiry, the state action inquiry, in the event the court reaches that inquiry. The first circumstance in which state action was found to be present occurs when a patient's outside physician or a physician on the staff of a nursing home decides to decrease or increase the level of the patient's care because his condition has become worse or because it's become better. In our brief, we refer to the decision of the nursing home staff physician as a nursing home decision or transfer, and we refer to the decision of the outside physician as the decision of a private physician, albeit both of those decisions are private action within the constraints of the Court of Appeals decision below. The second circumstance in which state action was found to be present occurs when a utilization review committee or a physician member of that committee decides to increase a patient's level of care because his condition has become worse. Parenthetically, it should be noted that utilization review is a federally required peer review system, that a utilization review decision about a change in care for a patient who is already in a nursing home is made during a portion of that process called continued stay review, and the continued stay review is addressed to whether or not the patient needs nursing home care at all, and if he does, what kind of care he needs. Two further points with respect to utilization review, and that is the utilization review physician's decision to change a level of care is final once made if it is not opposed by the patient's own physician, and that requirement is specific to the federal regulations, which are found at 42 CFR 556-336 and 42 CFR 556-436, and the state regulations track the federal regulations in that regard. In addition, if the utilization review physician decides that the patient needs this upward change in level of care and his decision is opposed by the patient's private physician, if two utilization review physicians agree, then the decision of the utilization review committee becomes final, again, under the regulations that I just called to your attention.
How much time do these physicians spend in this process as compared to the time they spend taking care of the patients?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at Part 42 CFR 456-330 following, which describes these various utilization review procedures in quite tedious detail, I think you would have to conclude that he spends a great deal of time. However, I can't, in fact, give you an exact estimate, but certainly we have no indication that the physicians who serve on these committees are not attending to the care of their patients, at least in this record. Petitioners contend that the district court should never have reached the transfers that are an issue and that I just described with respect to in the circumstances I just described. And that's because there was no plaintiff and no class representative before the district court who could have raised the issues. Not only was there no one who had such a transfer or was threatened with such a transfer, there certainly was no one who had the reality of or the prospect of the kind of distinct and palpable injury that Article 3 requires.
But there was a case or controversy of some kind at the time the case began.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There was a case or controversy with respect
about some other
about
some other kinds of
movements. There was a case or controversy with respect to the claims of the named respondents and the named interveners, and that case or controversy rested on their claims that URCs had improperly transferred them to lower levels of care, not URCs.
And that dispute was settled.
That dispute was the initial predicate in this case. It was initially decided by a preliminary injunction back in January of 1978. It went up to the Court of Appeals in the first Court of Appeals decision in this case, and it was ultimately resolved, as you indicate, on October 17, 1979, by the first partial final judgment in this case, which was entered on consent.
In the district court.
Yes, it was resolved in the district court.
Well, and why didn't the case end then?
That's exactly my question.
Did you ask the court to end it then?
Pardon me?
Did you ask the court to end the case then?
Or? No, Your Honor. The assistants then —
and you went right ahead and litigated these other issues.
That is correct, Your Honor. The assistants handling the case at that point did indeed go ahead and litigate these other issues through the Court of Appeals and to this court on the petition here today.
And you're raising a case of controversy here for the first time?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But you submitted these issues in the Court of Appeals.
You
litigated those issues without objection in the Court of Appeals.
The merits of the issues were indeed litigated without objection in the Court of Appeals. And I would add one point to that, Your Honor. When it came time to consider the preparation of the petition for certiorari in this case, and Mrs. Siegel was then Solicitor General of the State of New York, she is no longer, and myself and the assistants who aided me reviewed the record in this case, which was quite lengthy, we came to the conclusion that the Article III question was fairly presented by the record. We also observed that it had not been raised before, and we had detailed conversations with Mrs. Siegel as to whether or not we should call it to your attention. The conclusion of those conversations was that we could not, consistent with the standards of our practice, fail to call them to your attention, lest this Court reach the merits of a case involving constitutional rulings, which was not adequately presented in terms of Article III.
Counsel, if the question were properly before the lower courts dealing with the transfer to a higher level of care, would New York have stipulated eventually to the procedures for handling them, as was done on transfers to lower level of care?
That's a very interesting point, Your Honor. At page 14 of our main brief, we describe briefly what the state policies were before the judgment on review came up. One of the state policies with respect to URC transfers to higher levels of care, which you just called to my attention, was that those transfers would be, in effect, advisory. In other words, the state of New York, the Medicaid authorities, would not change the level of benefits based on a URC decision. It would simply await what the doctor did, what the URC did. If the patient ultimately got transferred by virtue of that URC decision, then it would adjust the benefits. If it didn't, if the patient didn't get transferred, they would leave the benefits intact. Now, aside from substantial equity problems that were involved in that policy, which was, of course, superseded by this judgment, namely, there were people in nursing homes who, in fact, needed a much more intensive level of care and were not receiving it, that being one of the equities on a change of policy side. The federal government came along and advised us that although they had required hearings on URC transfers to lower levels of care, that our FFP, our federal financial participation, was in serious jeopardy if we afforded hearings on higher levels of care. And the letters with respect to that appear in the second supplement to the joint appendix, which includes some letters referred to in respondent's brief at page 4, note 4. In other words, respondents refer to a letter by Commissioner Blum to the federal authorities saying, can't we please give hearings on URC transfers to higher levels of care now, since you already told us as a program requirement, not as a constitutional requirement, that we have to give them on transfers to lower levels of care. That's the first letter in the second supplement.
All right, so your answer is federal government.
The answer from the federal government was that they did not perceive that to be an effective way of utilization review, at least for transfers to higher levels of care.
You have, I think, taken the position in your brief that private transfer decisions for patients in nursing homes are medical decisions unaffected by the state. Now, what about a decision by the nursing home itself to transfer when made by someone other than a physician? Is that a medical decision?
Well, it can be or it can't be, depending on what the facts are. And as I indicated, we don't have any plaintiffs who present the facts that would support those kinds of conclusions. However, when we viewed this judgment, we thought of it as pertaining really only to medical decisions, decisions by a nursing home's medical director, and therefore medically predicated, all right? There is a possible other reading, which respondents point out, essentially at page 22 of their brief and throughout their brief, that a nursing home, not through its medical director, but through its administrator, might want to discharge somebody because he's a bad patient or for some other non-medical reason. Now, those discharges, in fact, present this case in microcosm because those kinds of discharges are covered by something called the Patient's Bill of Rights, which is codified in federal regulations and codified in state regulations. And what that Bill of Rights says is, if you are transferred by your nursing home, presumably a human being who has made a decision who's affiliated with the nursing home, if you were transferred for non-medical reasons, for non-payment, for your own welfare, you have a right to challenge that nursing home decision. You don't have a right to bring a Medicaid reimbursement claim against the state in a fair hearing to get money. That doesn't do you any good. You have a right to bring a private action against the nursing home. And we suggest to you that the kinds of medical decisions that are at issue in this case, made as they are by these private URCs, the facility medical director, the staff physician, your outside physician, present exactly the same kind of private transactions as the purely, as respondents call them, the purely non-medical needs decisions, and that the remedy for these, if there is to be a remedy, is against the people who made the decisions, not in a request to the state to pay you money for a service that an individual in the private sector has already refused to provide you.
Let me ask you one more question while you're interrupted. Do transfer decisions, even those made by private physicians, have to be made by applying state-defined criteria?
The state prescribes the use of what respondents have called, and what are in fact, a DMS-1 form and a DMS-9 form. Those forms can be found, they're not referenced in respondents' briefs, but they can be found in Appendix C-1 to Volume C of Title 10 of the New York Code Rules and Regulations. They are displayed there in full. Now, the state has prescribed those forms, and what those forms consist of are, one, a standard sheet, which assigns, in fact, the sheet is called New York State Numerical Standards Master Sheet. That's the DMS-9 form. And the DMS-1 form is called the New York State Long-Term Care Placement Form. And what those forms do is describe certain kinds of medical conditions, certain kinds of patient conditions, in other words, self-care and dressing, needs help, needs total help, and certain other kinds of conditions, such as needs restraints, required, is assaulted. And the numerical standards assign certain weights to these depending on when the condition occurs. Now, those two forms used in combination, and they are used throughout this process, including with respect to these medical decisions, create what are called predictor scores. If you get a score of 60, you're arguably appropriate for intermediate, for an intermediate care facility. If you get a score of 180, you're arguably appropriate for an SNF or skilled nursing facility.
Can a patient be transferred who doesn't meet the state criteria?
Now, respondents say that those forms determine the choice. In other words, the fact that the doctor has to use this form means that the state has made up his mind for it. The answer to that is absolutely no. The specific regulations which control the use of these forms, namely 10 New York Code Rules and Regulations, Section 415.1A2 and Section 420.1B, state in terms that all the physician who gets this form has to do to say that his patient needs another kind of care that is not consistent with the predictor score is say so. In other words, the physician has an override. The form does not foreclose the patient's access to the kind of care that the doctor wants to see him have, and it doesn't determine what the doctor is supposed to do.
Mrs. Gordon, we've granted certiorari on just two questions here, relatively narrow, and about half of your time is gone.
Very well, Your Honor. I would just like to point out one other factor with respect to these DMS-1 forms, because in the entire array of federal and state laws which the respondents bring to bear on their argument, which was not the Court of Appeals' argument, that state action is somehow found in these transfers because the state forces them, the only point that needs clarification is, in fact, the use of these DMS-1 forms. Justice O'Connor, if I just might finish, the respondents also say that somehow, even if we use these forms and they're not specifically controlled by the state, their results are not specifically controlled by the state, that we, at some point, review them and we determine whether they are correctly drawn or incorrectly drawn and disapprove or approve the physician choices that appear on those forms. That is an absolutely incorrect statement. The portion of the record that the respondents cite for that point is an affidavit by Donald Davidoff, which is document 18 of the Record on Appeal, and the affidavit simply doesn't say that, and that is not, in fact, what we do. We leave the forms as we find them. We do collect them. We use them for statistical purposes, and it is possible that in the course of receiving those forms or in the course of another procedure that the petition that the respondents called to your attention, which are called periodic medical reviews and independent professional reviews, which are audits essentially of the quality of care offered in nursing homes, it is possible that in the course of any of this regulatory complex, that the state might indeed find a nursing home patient who was inappropriately placed. That didn't happen in this case, certainly not on these facts, but if the state were to find that patient and it were to direct that patient's removal from a nursing home, well, then certainly we wouldn't be here today arguing this case. That would be a state-initiated transfer, and New York at least would not come before this court and claim that state action was not present. But the kinds of transfers that were decided below are all medically initiated for reasons determined by private parties and have nothing whatsoever to do with the state's control, intervention, or forcing of any of the decisions at issue. Returning just briefly to the standing point, Your Honor, respondents make essentially two arguments against petitioners' claim that they lack standing. The first depends on their acknowledgement that indeed in January of 1978, the district court did enjoin the URC transfers to lower levels of care. But they turn around and then they say that notwithstanding that injunction, the same individuals, presumably the respondents and the interveners, were subject to the same kind of risk, albeit the injunction was enforced, because the nursing home was going to adopt that URC decision as its own. It was going to simply say, oh, well, URC, you're enjoined, now we are going to enforce that. We're going to make the same choice and disregard the order. Well, the argument omits to point out that in the very order that enjoined the URCs, to wit the January 5, 1978 injunction, The nursing homes themselves were also enjoined. And therefore, the argument assumes that the nursing homes would have entered into some kind of subterfuge or circumvention of the order to make the same choice and say it was their own and not a URC order. The record is completely barren of any evidence which even suggests that the nursing homes sought to circumvent the order in this regard. And indeed, it is barren of any evidence that the nursing homes ever threatened or transferred any of the named respondents in any way whatsoever once the order was issued. Moreover, even if you accept the logic of the argument, it still fails because the injunction upon which it relies, namely URC transfers to lower levels of care, is not at all coextensive with the claims that the respondents sought to put before the court, namely including those claims to higher levels of care and to and URC and physician transfers to lower levels of care. A second argument that respondents make with respect to our claim that they lack standing relies on the speculation that there must be some other member of this class, even if it's not the named respondents and interveners, who in fact had a physician transfer to a higher level of care or a URC transfer to a higher level of care. I suggest to the court that that argument is impossible because the law has established that the claims of class members can never be broader than the claims of class representatives, and the only class representatives before the court below were indeed the named respondents and the interveners who only had the URC transfers to lower levels of care. Respondents also call to your attention two letters, actually three letters. Two are identical and one is slightly different, in support of their claim that some member of the class had these transfers. The letters are dated a year and a year and a half after the district court entered the last partial final judgment in this case, and they are appended to their brief in opposition to certiorari. And obviously, a transfer, even assuming the person who was receiving it was aggrieved, and these letters don't suggest that they were, a transfer happening to somebody a year and a half after the district court determined the claims that are in issue cannot serve to place those claims before the
district court. Well, do they purport to be transfers of named parties to the action?
There are two of the letters, Your Honor, dated December 18, 1980, are to nursing homes and do identify two individuals. As Your Honor reviews those letters, I think you will find, as I have found, that what they describe are the enforcement procedures under the partial final judgment that's an issue in this case. In other words, they were telling the nursing home liaison how to comply, and the patient is identified in that context. It is not suggested for a moment that any of the identified patients, or either of the identified patients, thought that they should have a hearing right on any of the transfers that are an issue, that they had, or even that they had any opinion at all. In other words, they do not show that these individuals were aggrieved by the on the same basis as aggrieved by the claims that were adjudicated below. As I indicated before, on the state action point, or as I perhaps should have indicated before, we think the state action analysis is controlled by Jackson versus Metropolitan Edison Co. We think that the close nexus between state and private action that that decision requires must be shown with respect to the state's imprimatur or weight or affirmative conduct with respect to one of the kinds of choices.
Before you get too deeply into the state action argument, just because it's hard for me to keep these proceedings clearly in mind, in the prior proceeding that is not now before us, which involved, as I understand it, downward decisions by URC, which might result, I guess, in the discharge of a patient from a nursing home, was it decided that there was state action involved there?
No, Your Honor, the issue never arose because in 1976, while a different case was in progress before the Southern District, the federal government advised us that hearings had to be held on URC transfers to lower levels of care. In other words, it was a Medicaid program requirement.
In other words, the hearing requirement was imposed by
exactly.
Federal regulation. In effect.
Right. And indeed, when they so advised us, and their exchange of letters on this point is referred to in our brief page 6 in the first in the footnote there, they characterize our antagonism, if you will, to providing hearings in that context as not the most reasoned approach to fair hearings to utilization review decisions. But
now,
they did indeed impose that requirement.
May I ask just one more question?
Sure.
At the last section of your opponent's brief, as I remember it, I haven't glanced at it right now, suggests that federal regulations or state regulations require hearings in everything that's before us now. Are those the same regulations that governed your decision in the downward URC transfers? And, or do they apply
the
to
same,
both up and
those
down?
Those are the same regulations which the federal government told us to apply in the downward URC transfers, which, as I just noted to you, characterizing themselves as not the most reasoned application of the regulations. And the reason that it is not the most reasoned applications is what makes those regulations inapplicable here. And in fact, Your Honor, I will close with that. The regulations require fair hearings for agency action, reducing or terminating assistance, or denying a service, essentially. And they are much like the fair hearing regulations in Goldberg versus Kelly or available in other assistance programs. The decision to the decision to transfer a patient, at least in the context of this case, is not an agency decision. And so much is revealed by the exhibit letter from the federal government, which is attached to our brief, wherein the letter acknowledges that if a physician made this choice, not the URC, then there would be no fair hearing requirement obligation. In other words,
let me just get this one question out then, and then I'll, why, if there is a URC decision to increase the level of care, which would require moving a patient from one place to another, and which might give rise to this phenomenon of transfer trauma, why wouldn't the regulation apply to that? Because it would be, in
first
effect,
of all,
a denial
as
of the existing care.
As the federal government views the regulations, a transfer to a higher level of care normally results in an increase in assistance, all right, not a reduction or termination of assistance. So in that sense, it's inapposite, although there are some exceptions in New York because we have a varying rate system. But certainly, our rate system is not coextensive with all transfers, so it's out on that basis. Second, it's not agency action. And it's out on that basis. No matter how one characterizes it, albeit the federal government did and would withhold our FFP if we disagreed with them on URC down transfers, under the decision in this case, the Court of Appeals decision, the URC is a private body, not the state agency, and therefore it could not make the relevant decision. But perhaps more importantly, if we want to put aside all the technical deficiencies in the terms of the regulations, I think we come back to what I indicated to Justice O'Connor before, and that is that the fair hearing does not address the issues. The dispute here is between the URC and the patient, the physician, and the patient. If I take a fair hearing and the state therefore then says to me, well, all right, we'll continue to reimburse Mrs. X's SNF care, that doesn't mean that her doctor is going to give her that care. That doesn't mean that the facility medical director is going to give her that care. That decision to provide the facility with money does not change the doctor's mind. Thank you.
Mr. Kirkland.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The respondents contain that the record in this case clearly discloses the existence of a justiciable controversy between the parties. The justiciability inquiry focuses properly on three main areas of concern: the circumstances of the named plaintiffs at the time of the consent judgment, the joint pretrial order in this case, and the standing allegations of the organizational plaintiff, the Gray Panthers. With the entry of the consent judgment, which ended the implementation of adverse utilization review committee determinations, the named plaintiffs and class members came under the immediate threat of being transferred out of their facilities by the facilities themselves. It is the unequivocal command of applicable state law that a nursing facility must promptly transfer, without a hearing, any Medicaid patient who is thought not to need that level of care. Thus, Section 505.20 of the State Department of Social Services regulations state simply and clearly that patients who no longer need skilled nursing or health-related facility care shall be discharged promptly.
What are the sanctions which the state attaches to a violation of what you describe as its command?
Your Honor, the penalties that can ensue if a facility fails to promptly discharge a Medicaid patient are retroactive denial of reimbursement for services rendered, fines, and suspension from the Medicaid program itself.
But it isn't a question of a public health type of regulation where they would shut down the facility if they failed to comply, I take it. It's more like a regulation governing a contractor with the state.
I imagine that that might be the case. What's significant is that the state commands the result. It backs it up with a certain kinds of sanctions.
Well, but I take it the nursing home is perfectly free to say, we'll go without the money and operate as we choose.
Well, Your Honor, we assume that nursing homes, like everybody else, will comply with the law.
Well, so supposing that the state of New York is contracted for the production of 20,000 envelopes or something like that with a contractor, and it has certain sanctions attaching to the contractor's failing to comply with certain production regulations. Now, if the contractor doesn't comply, he won't get paid by the state of New York. But you wouldn't say that the contractor is commanded to comply with those regulations.
Well, let me distinguish two situations that might be helpful. If a private doctor, for example, were providing services to a Medicaid patient, and the state, as in your hypothetical, declined retroactively to pay the physician, it's true that the physician might in the future decline to provide services. Now, that's in sharp contrast to what happens here. The state here doesn't just say that if you don't do something, it doesn't simply say we're retroactively possibly going to deny compensation for services rendered. It directly requires, it specifically says to the facility, if that patient doesn't need that level of care, you shall promptly discharge that patient without a hearing. It has behind it, obviously, certain sanctions like any affirmative command of the state, but it is the nature of that command which doesn't just impose an indirect harm on the patient, but it interferes directly with that patient's right to be in that facility. The conduct of the government directly commands that the facility must move the patient.
And the sanction isn't that the facility becomes unlicensed or goes to jail, but simply that money is cut off, which it otherwise would have received.
Well, more than that, Your Honor, the facility stands not just to lose compensation for services rendered, stands to be fined, it stands to lose its right to participate in the Medicaid program. And that's very serious in the state of New York, because more than 90% of the patients in nursing facilities in New York State are Medicaid patients. Literally, the facility depends for its very survival on being part of the Medicaid program.
What is the fine?
The fines, I believe, Your Honor, can be up to $1,000 a day for violations.
So it does have some aspects of a public health regulation, then?
To that extent, I guess it does, but in addition, there are these other serious sanctions. And sanctions which, if applied...
Do those sanctions apply, counsel, to a failure to move the patient up to a higher, more expensive level of care?
That's right, Your Honor. The state regulation that I cited at 505.20 specifically requires facility to move a patient who doesn't need that level of care. The regulations of the State Department of Health additionally say that a facility must promptly transfer a patient whose care is inadequate, that is, who should be moved to a higher level of care. Further, those same regulations require that a patient must be promptly moved, again without a hearing, if the patient is otherwise inappropriately placed because of a behavior problem, emotional disorder, some other problem that jeopardizes the welfare of that patient or of other patients in the facility.
Well, you still have the problem of fact that the decision to transfer isn't the state's, at least in the first instance?
In some sense, it is the state's, Your Honor, for this reason. The regulation that I cited of the State Department of Social Services also states that the facility's judgment about whether a patient needs a level of care that's provided there must be based on the assessment of that patient as against the state's long-term care assessment form, called the DMS-1.
Right, right. So the standards are supplied by the state.
That's right.
Well, the standards state, are, but the decision is made not by a state official, but by a private party. And you have to nevertheless say that that private action is state action.
That's right, Your Honor. We.
And what's your bridge? How do you get to that?
The bridge, Your Honor, is the argument that when the state puts its weight on the side of private conduct, even if that initiative comes from a private party, by ordering it, by compelling it, by directing it.
Compelling what?
Compelling the facility.
Well, they compel the decision to be made.
No, more than that.
Well, and they provide the standards.
More than that.
What?
The
what?
State requires that the facility kick the patient out.
Well, not until the decision is made.
By a private party.
Not until the decision is made. You still have to decide that the decision is a state decision.
Respondents contend that where, even if the initiative came from a private party.
Initiative, it's the decision. The decision that someone needs less or more care.
Well, the decision, the standard is whether the person needs that level of care. That's
exactly.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's
well,
no
that's
different
the decision
than,
I'm talking about now. Is that a, and you must claim that that's a state decision.
We submit that when the state enforces that result by requiring the facility to kick the patient out, that the state is involved in that eviction of the patient from the facility sufficient to require the state, when the state requires it, the state should hold a hearing to decide whether there is a violation of applicable federal and state law which prohibits a facility
so you say
from kicking
the,
out.
So you say the enforcement mechanism involves the state sufficiently to be blamed for the decision to transfer or to some other facility.
That's our primary argument, that when the state
is directs. This argument, may I just inquire, is this argument limited to nursing homes? Say you had a hospital and the state says there's a shortage of hospital beds and rooms, so the state passes a law and says that when a patient reaches a certain level of recuperation, that the hospital must discharge him if the doctor thinks it's okay to do so. Would those be state decisions to discharge? Say a mother delivers a child, must be discharged in 48 hours,
well,
absent some emergency.
I think it's true that there are similar requirements for Medicaid patients.
But would those decisions then by the doctor to say, well, you're well enough to go home, be a state decision under your analysis?
Yes, we maintain that if the state, again.
Or say they had a state law that said don't prescribe a certain drug unless certain symptoms are present. Don't give them too much aspirin. And every time a doctor prescribes aspirin, is that state action?
Again, Your Honor, the difference there is that the state doesn't tell a doctor you can't provide care that you think is required. It would merely say in the case of a Medicaid patient that perhaps retroactively you won't be paid for that. The state does more here, and that's the
well,
point.
Well, in my hypothetical, I was assuming it was a firm requirement of law. You just don't overprescribe medicine. Don't keep people in the hospital too long. Otherwise, you'll be sanctioned by fines and all the rest. That would make it a state action every time the doctor.
It would not, because we maintain there is a difference.
And what is the difference?
The difference is this, that if the state merely said in this case to a nursing facility, you ought not to provide inappropriate care, with the consequences that might follow, that if they did so, they might not be paid, we don't insist that that's state action. It is state action, though, when the state goes beyond that and says to the facility, if that patient isn't properly there, kick them out immediately without a hearing. Indeed, the whole incentive, the incentive of the state to do this is self-evident. It's a cost containment concern. It's not a concern that the facility.
Well, Mr. Kirkland, that's the point. I thought we were dealing here only with transfers to higher levels of care. I thought that was what was left and what we were concerned with. Is that right?
It's not just that issue, Your Honor.
As I read the briefs, the questions that we had here involved only the questions of transfers to higher levels of care, and secondly, whether there was an Article III standing problem. I thought those were the two questions. Now, the court resolved below the question of simply terminating the care altogether or assigning the patient to a lower level of care. And, in fact, the parties stipulated that in those situations a fair hearing would be required. And I understood that the litigation below and your argument below was based on the reduction of benefits that would ensue, and that gave the state its financial interest. Now, when you're talking about a higher level of care, the state doesn't have the same interest. It's going to cost the state a lot more money. And they're not eager to send some patient to a higher level of care and pay more money. So now you're making a totally new argument that I understand was not made in the courts below at all, that because of state regulation on the standards, that makes the physician's decision state action. Have I summarized it correctly?
Your Honor, let me explain what happened below. There was a consent judgment. That consent judgment resolved the controversy between plaintiffs and defendants about implementation of utilization review committee determinations. Ms. Gordon has explained utilization review committees. Those determinations were to discharge a patient, transfer him to a lower level of care. We settled that. The state said, we're not going to enforce those determinations. They're too traumatic. They're too harmful to the patient. Now, what that left was the following. It left the facilities themselves capable, not only capable, but required, as I've explained, to move those patients if they don't need that level of care. The state never maintained these people didn't need that level of care. The state never retreated from its support of the so-called DMS-1 instrument as a way of assessing that level of care. When the Utilization Review Committee route to moving patients was closed, then these plaintiffs came under the threat of the state law that I've described, that facilities must promptly move them. Before that time, facilities could rely upon the utilization review process as a way of moving inappropriately placed patients. Now, both parties in the lower court understood full well that the threat that the facilities themselves would move these patients crystallized with the entry of the consent judgment. With the entry of the consent judgment, which the state resisted up to the last minute, the utilization review route was suddenly closed shut as a way to move these plaintiffs. Each one of these plaintiffs, though, had been assessed against the state's DMS-1 instrument and had been found by that evaluation, which plaintiffs challenged, not to need that level of care. Now, with a consent judgment entered, the only way that the facilities could comply with the requirement of state law that they must promptly, without a hearing, move inappropriately placed patients was to move them themselves. The utilization review route was closed. The plaintiffs moved quickly when that threat existed to have the issue adjudicated, simply because any delay in the resolution of that question obviously carried with it the serious risk that these transfers would be accomplished.
But Ms. Gordon informed us, and maybe I misunderstood her, that the injunction prohibited the nursing homes from doing just that. Was I wrong in understanding that?
That is not a correct statement of the situation. By the consent judgment, the state agreed that for its part, it would not approve or enforce adverse utilization review committee determinations. Consent judgment left facilities free to move patients. And indeed, the state blast laws.
But they were no longer required to, because they were freed of the compulsion, as I understood it, of the URC determination. Isn't that right?
They were free of the obligation. The state, when the state adopts a URC.
In other words, to put it differently, weren't they free to say, we're going to keep this patient here and there's nothing the state can do to us if we do?
No, they
weren't?
They were not. The state no longer was going to make the facility move the patient out because of a review committee determination. However, the facilities were left free to move patients if they thought they weren't properly placed. And indeed, state law requires facilities on their own, wholly apart from the review committee functions, to move out patients not properly there. That's the distinction. The state, for its own part, the state said, we tie our hands. We are not going to be responsible anymore for making facilities move patients because there has been an adverse review committee determination. The state thought that too harmful, too traumatic. The parties both recognized, and that's why the state has fought this issue, that the facilities themselves not only were free, but should be free to move patients on their own. And respondents contend that the state law is clear that they have to. Indeed, that's the only way that the facilities now could discharge their obligation under law to move any inappropriately placed patients. Indeed, it's precisely
because... What prohibits them from doing it right now?
What prohibits them now, Your Honor, is the deterrent effect of a hearing at which these plaintiffs could test the validity of
what
the...
What kind of a hearing? A state hearing?
What the district court required, after finding that there was state action and due process protection, was that the state had to provide a hearing forum in which the plaintiffs, the named plaintiffs...
State had to provide a hearing forum...
That's right.
...to decide as to whether a private hospital could change its status of a patient.
To decide whether the decision upon which the facility based its transfer was under federal and state law. Correct. Federal and state law says a facility can't move a patient unless it's for good medical reasons.
What federal law says that in this case, in this posture, with this injunction, can't do it? What federal law says that Hospital A, privately owned, privately financed, cannot change the status of a patient?
Well, Your Honor, that's the traditional barrier that's imposed by the law in the context of a review committee determination.
I'm talking about federal law now.
Federal law requires if there, for example, if doctors...
What federal law requires a private hospital to give a hearing?
The regulations, the federal regulations that Ms. Gordon discussed that state that when a review committee determines a patient should be moved and that there's a Medicaid adjustment at issue, the state has to provide a so-called fair hearing.
Well, now, this wasn't the Court of Appeals decision.
Reason of the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals went on a constitutional basis, and I thought your submission was Constitution, too. I thought your answer might be to Justice Marshall that it's the 14th Amendment that requires a hearing.
Well, we maintain that it does, of course.
But you now say it's the federal regulation.
We say both.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to respond to Justice Marshall's...
You're trying to get a private hospital under the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. That's what I understood you'd be trying to do.
Well, we are trying to do that because this case is unique.
Of course, if you're right about if you're right about the regulations, we really should not reach any constitutional question, should we?
That's
did
correct.
Did you talk about the regulations before the Court of Appeals?
Yes, we did.
And did they reject your view of the regulations?
They didn't reach that issue.
Well, how do you know they didn't? They just didn't write about it.
That's true. They didn't write about it.
Well, if they were construing or deciding the case in an orthodox manner, if they reached the constitutional question, they must have rejected your claim under the regulations.
Exactly.
Because presumably they don't reach a constitutional question if there's a statutory or regulation way of disposing of the case.
I guess that's true.
They rejected your regulatory submission.
Impliedly, as Justice Rehnquist characterized it.
Was it briefed?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
On both sides?
Yes.
Was the federal people take any position on the matter?
Not officially before the court, no.
How did they construe their own regulations? Or do you know?
Well,
or is it in the record?
There is nothing officially in the record about HHS's position, but...
Well, insofar as transfers to higher levels of care are concerned, and I still think that's one of the issues before
yes,
us,
is.
As I understand it.
Yes,
is not the federal position that no hearing is required for the transfers to higher levels of care?
That is right, Your Honor.
You concede that, so you're not here making that argument to us, that it's required by federal regulation.
I'm not here making the argument that federal and state fair hearing regulations apply to transfers up.
Okay, but you are saying that the 14th Amendment requires it.
That is right. And as well, we're saying that these fair hearing regulations apply to transfers to a lower level of care or out of facility into an adult home or the community because there is a reduction.
And you and the petitioners differ on whether the consent decree covers those transfers to a lower level or out.
We do not disagree about that at all. We both understand that discharges because of utilization review committee determinations are forbidden. We're in a full agreement that the consent judgment does not apply to facility-initiated transfers or discharges.
And you did argue below only on the basis of the reduction in financial benefits as the basis for holding that there was state action. Is that right?
No, we did not, Your Honor. We argued with respect to transfers to a higher level of care and to a lower level of care that the 14th Amendment requires prior hearings. With respect...
You don't... I think that your submission here on the state action is not certainly isn't in defense of the Court of Appeals rationale, is it?
We do not retreat from the Court of Appeals rationale, but we believe that there is a simpler method of disposing of the state action question, which is that
the state enforces a decision,
requires it, orders it. That's
well,
right.
So wouldn't you say the same thing then if there was a general state law that about trespass or something, and the home decides to move a patient, the patient refuses to go, so the home goes to court and gets a order, just for self-protection, gets an order to move the person out. That's state enforcement of a private decision. Would you say that is automatically state action?
Well, no. I would say that when the state provides a forum for deciding whether there is a violation, that the mere provision of a judicial forum by itself.
The trespass action wouldn't give any hearing on the validity of the private decision. It would just say, are you here without consent?
Well, the question, Your Honor, in this context is that, again, that the federal and state regulations themselves say that a facility can't move a person unless for valid medical reasons.
Well, the general law says a person cannot stay on somebody else's property without consent, and a court will enforce it.
Well, here it's a question of the of well, Your Honor, we think that for example, in the Moose Lodge case, where this court had no trouble saying that if the state liquor control board has a regulation that says we're going to enforce a bylaw of a private club, even though it's neutral in its terms, that's state action. We submit that this is no different, where the state says that regulation that says we're going to direct the nursing home to kick out a patient if the patient isn't thought to be appropriately there. We think that is state action as well.
Or to raise the standards, you said before. If you enhance the care, give them higher care, more benefits, you also have to have a due process hearing.
Well, we maintain that we do, that it is required because there are both due process protected interests there as well, because the regs again say.
Well, even on that theory, you'd be saying that under Goldberg against Kelly, if some welfare director wants to increase the welfare payments to a recipient, they'd have to have a hearing, a Goldberg-Kelly hearing.
No, we would not, because there's no property interest under law protect someone against getting more benefits. Here the regulations say you can't transfer a patient up or down or out unless for good cause. And that's the difference.
What is the property interest if the transfer is to a higher level of care?
Your Honor, the federal and state regulations state that a nursing facility may not transfer or discharge. That's the language.
Well, I'm asking you what the property interest is. Do you have a property interest if somebody wants to give you more money? Property interest to decline it?
The property interest is the interest which is embedded in positive state and federal law that says that you should be free of having to move to a higher level of care unless there's good reason to do it. And the reason why that's done is not surprising, because as indicated in deposition in this case, when people are asked to go to a higher level of care, they think they're dying. And the trauma...
How do we know that makes them think they're dying? There's something in the records, in medical opinion to that effect?
Not to that precise effect. What is in the record, Your Honor, is the whole underpinning of the consent judgment. And it's in the record that the defendants made it very clear, affidavit statements in the commissioner's letter to the federal government, that the reason why it refused to enforce review committee determinations was because the move itself was so devastating, so harmful to patients, that it should not be done.
Do you think there's no trauma involved in an adversary hearing?
There is, of course, trauma involved, but we don't maintain that a finding of transfer trauma is necessary on the narrow issues that, as Your Honor pointed out, are before the court, which is whether the state action and on the standing issue as well, that this court did not take the questions of whether there are protected property or liberty interests involved. We don't think that they're critical.
Well, how can the hearing — the Chief Justice's question makes me wonder, how could the pre-transfer hearing provide protection against this concern you express about the consequences of a transfer to a higher level? If the reason is that there's greater danger of mortality, how does it help to make them spell it out in a hearing for the man?
Well, because that's not the only issue, Your Honor.
But that would be a part — I mean, if that's one of the reasons, you're saying the patient must be given the bad news in details, what you're saying.
That would be part of the issue. The other part, again, in the regulations, which talks about that a transfer can't be accomplished unless it's in the interest of the patient for his welfare, is that if that patient could show that he or she had lived in a nursing home for 20 years and they proposed to send that patient out of New York City to upstate New York on some erroneous medical judgment.
Well, is there a case at all like that in this record before us?
There are.
I can imagine some cases with extreme facts might present a problem, but we have to decide. Is there anything in this record that requires us to decide a case of that kind?
Of the transfers to a higher level of care?
Yes. Where it's harmful to the patient to give them the added protection.
The evidence that we have here as part of the joint pretrial order is that during a period in which this case was in litigation, and when the state did provide hearings, at one point it did, there were, the defendant state, at least 10 cases of transfers to a higher level of care. 5 were reversed at hearing.
Yeah, but are any of those litigants that are involved in this case?
Those litigants, those persons were members of the class. None of them are named plaintiffs in this case. Your Honor, I want to briefly point out some significant aspects of the joint pretrial order in this case. In that case, in that joint pretrial order, there were the allegations made that a substantial proportion of facility transfers of Medicaid patients are improper under federal and state law. Defendants did not controvert that particular allegation. That is, at the stage of the case where in affidavit form and in a statement under local court rules, the defendants identified what allegations of the plaintiffs they disagreed with, they did not controvert that. And we submit that it is significant here, when the class was defined without objection, without appeal by the defendants, to include all Medicaid patients in nursing facilities in New York State, and given this allegation, the class members were transferred improperly, not controverted by the defendants. Standing was never interposed as a basis for objection below. But that class certification can bridge the gap between the allegations of the named plaintiffs and the allegations unrefuted, unobjected to by the defendants concerning class members. When there was no objection taken to the certification of the class, no appeal taken in the statement of controverted issues, that proposition, that allegation about class members was not contested.
Well, your time has expired, Mr. Kirkland.
Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mrs. Gordon?
Yes, Your Honor. I have just a few.
May I ask before you start, are the Gray Panthers parties to this case?
Not so far as I'm concerned, Your Honor.
They're not listed as parties.
They are listed as parties. They were apparently parties in the first half of this case, which ended with the consent judgment back in 1979, the October one. But if Your Honor turns to the pretrial order, which starts at, I believe, page 250 of the appendix, 150 of the appendix, you will find that in the description of the nature of the action and proceedings and in the nature of the parties, which is on page
150. Ms. Gordon, if you'll stay on the microphones, we'll hear you better.
I'm sorry. That in the description of the nature of the action and proceedings at page 150 and following at page 151, the nature of the parties, the Gray Panthers are not described, and we have considered, as we indicated in our brief, that their claims were abandoned. If they were not abandoned, we also believe that their standing was not made out.
Our rules require that the parties be identified. Are they identified in the petition for
writ of certiorari? I beg your pardon, Your Honor. I couldn't hear you.
Our rules require that parties be identified. I didn't find that they were included in the list of parties in the petition for certiorari. Were they or not? Maybe the counsel on the other side could tell us.
Yes, Your Honor. They're listed among the parties before this court. Yes.
Where?
What page?
Petition itself.
Well, that's all right. I don't want to detain
definitely
you.
Definitely listed among the
they're
parties.
They're listed.
Yes.
Thank you.
Justice O'Connor, just a point of clarification. It is not only URC transfers to higher levels of care that are an issue in this case. It is also the medical decisions of the outside physician and the nursing home physician that are an issue. With respect to whether or not there was anything in the record which spoke to the federal, whether or not HHS was requiring hearings in the circumstances before the court, I call your attention to the exhibit that concludes our brief, wherein HHS, then ATW, states at page 2A, a change in medical care ordered by a patient's physician does not represent an agency proposal to terminate, suspend, or reduce assistance payment. If a patient disagrees with his physician's determination of medical necessity for a specific service, his recourse is to the practitioner or his professional association, not to the medical assistance agency. And again, I call your attention to the second supplement to the joint appendix, wherein the letters that follow Commissioner Blum's letter show that the federal government not only did not consider URC transfers upward subject to fair hearing rights, but they threatened to withdraw our FFP if we provided fair hearing rights with respect to them.
Mrs. Gordon, on this matter of the Gray Panthers, this petition is yours, isn't it? States that it is.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And it says Barbara Blum, et cetera, against, and it names a number of people, and the Gray Panthers, New York chapter.
Yes.
You thought it, when this was filed, you thought they were respondents, didn't you?
Yes. It was not that they are not technical parties. They were listed in the caption, Your Honor. It's just that they, one, had no standing in the original case, and to the extent that one has to rely on the post-consent judgment claims, which are now before you,
well,
the Gray Panthers.
The judgment of the Court of Appeals mentions them.
Yes, they are listed.
And that's the judgment that's here.
That is correct, Your Honor. There's
so
no.
Aren't they here?
Yes, Your Honor, they are parties here in terms of their technical inclusion in the caption. However, they made no sufficient claims at the outset.
They are here also as technically in the judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is not quite technical. That's the judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
You've never made an objection to that, have you?
I don't have an objection to their appearing in the caption. I have an objection to finding by reason thereof or any other predicate that they had standing in the first instance in this case or that they had any claims specifically.
And where did you raise that objection? Right
we didn't.
Now?
As I indicated earlier.
You raised it now.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You didn't raise it before.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't it a little late?
That's correct, Your Honor, but for the fact that it is a jurisdictional objection and cannot be waived, and as I indicated earlier, would not have been presented to this Court were it not for serious conversations on that point with the Solicitor General.
I am not bound by your serious conversation with your Solicitor General.
That's certainly true, Your Honor. I would call the Court's attention to one portion of the legislative history with respect to utilization review, which I think makes it abundantly clear that utilization.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
We'll hear arguments next in Schweiker.